This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. Hello and welcome to In Conversation with Xuan Chan. Now, achieving carbon neutrality by 2050 in the built environment is an ambition that governments, businesses, and many individuals are striving to achieve. But in our efforts to tackle this, sometimes we forget the personalities behind the cause. So I'm delighted that Xuan Chan, head of ESG for the Real Assets Division here at LGIM, has taken some time out of her busy day to take us with her on her more personal journey. From her early career in asset management through to her light bulb ESG moment, and what she sees are the opportunities and challenges of her current role at LGIM. Xuan, welcome to LGIM Talks. Now, you haven't always been involved in the area of ESG, have you? Perhaps you could tell us a bit about your early career years.
I started my career in the capital markets back in the 90s during what's called the Asian Tiger economies. So this was a very exciting time because there was very strong economic growth and opportunities in countries like Hong Kong, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan. And so there were lots of opportunities in developing the financial markets during that time. And during my career there, I experienced the Asian financial crisis in 1997. And I was with HSBC at the time doing fixed income origination. And they then posted me to London. So I've been in the UK for 20 over years. And after business school, I moved into asset management, where I was part of a founding team where we built an asset management business around the European credit markets. It was a busy time. And then we made a decision to sell that business in 2008, just before the global financial crisis hit. So that really, I would say, was my transition point.
So you say 2008, and 2008 was beginning to be a really difficult time in markets, and you'd lived through the Asian currency crisis as well, Xuan. Had you become a little bit disillusioned, would you say, with the whole asset management thing? Was there something that wanted to turn you towards other things, ESG perhaps?
Well, I certainly became disillusioned with the short-term nature of the financial system and sort of this lack of sustainability and resilience of the financial market. So I started asking lots and lots of questions. I really started going back to the drawing board because I was really interested in understanding, you know, how we could create more sustainable financial ecosystems and which has a societal impact. And at the same time, I came across the fourth report of the Interpanel Governmental Report on Climate Change, IPCC, back in, well, it was the 2007 report. And that was definitely a turning point for me because there was no such thing as ESG back then. And I just felt that I wanted from then on to use my financial experience and skills to work with organizations that, you know, that had a strong social and environmental purpose and figure out, you know, how I could create in my own way the sort of theory of change of how capital can be mobilized for positive change and also to avoid systemic economic risk as well. I helped to establish a climate investment fund that was focused on nature-based solutions.
This is all really interesting because the terminology you're sort of using now, I get, but in 2008, I can't remember, as you say, people talking like this in sort of terms of sustainability and responsible investing. And certainly, if you don't mind me saying, not a woman. So I suppose the other question I'd like to tease out of you, Xuan, is how to what extent do you think your background shaped your very much your foresightedness, if you like? I mean, you're not from the UK, are you?
No, I I'm not originally from the UK. I grew up on an island in Southeast Asia, in Malaysia, and I had a rather simple and idyllic childhood, really. I would be often cycling everywhere, bringing back animals that I'll find on the streets in my neighborhood, either wild tortoises or injured birds, and always annoy my mother about them. So you could say, you know, growing up where there was, you know, within the confines of a tropical setting, you could say I had a really strong sense of nature and also strong set of values, I suppose, instilled by my parents growing up. My mother was a teacher, and she always instilled in me the ethics of working hard and very much leaving the world a better place than when I found it. And so I do carry those values with me as I have, you know, forged through my career and the decisions I've made in my life, I think.
That sounds a wonderful upbringing, I have to say. Wonderful images in my head. But also, I mean, from your mother's point of view, you know, there you were having a really well-paid job in asset management, you know, very, very successful at a very young age, it sounds. And then you go into and decide that you want to do and work for the environment, which was lesser well known and probably much less well paid, if you don't mind me saying. I mean, what did your family think of that career decision?
They thought I was crazy. Why would I give up a successful career in the financial world and go, well, they thought I was basically going to save trees. So yeah, you could say it was a personal choice, and I was, in a way, it was an exciting time too, because I expanded my tribe, you could say my networks, and I was part of what was then a burgeoning climate movement. So I was the crazy one at parties trying to convince some capitalist banker or lawyer that the science of climate, you know, and that was real and it had a profound economic, social and environmental impact if we didn't do anything about it. So I was trying to appeal to their rationality rather than being the activist.
Okay, so there you were setting up your climate fund, as you've said, and then you found yourself going off to Paris. Here we are, 2015, COP21, I think it was then. How was that for you? Who did you meet? What did you do?
So I consider myself very fortunate to have been in Paris during the COP, when the Paris Agreement was conceived. It was quite surreal, really. And for the first time, having been at previous COPs, I saw for the first time the private sector engaging and acknowledging the impacts of climate change. And, you know, this is where the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, the task force was created, right? It's which is now TCFD is becoming, it's going to become mandatory
here
in the UK. So it was launched essentially by Michael Bloomberg and Mark Carney, was the governor of Bank of England at the time. And so it was really interesting to see this whole sort of convergence of the private and public sector and government coming together. And it was then, I suppose, I had this moment of reflection and realization that I had a role to play in helping institutional investors better understand climate risk, but also the opportunities ahead of ourselves in supporting a low carbon economy. So with some colleagues, we co-founded a purpose-driven advisory business where we worked closely with pension funds and different asset managers in helping to establish their, what was then, you know, the ESG or climate or impact beliefs and strategies.
And now, fast forward 5 years on from there, and here you are at LGIM. you know, how do you see your role playing out at LGIM?
I must say, I'm really excited to be in the real assets business, because I believe real assets has a pivotal role to play in supporting this low carbon economy and society. And so, you know, we are about investing in the backbone of the global economy. We are about long-term investing in the delivery of buildings and infrastructure, power regeneration, transportation, social infrastructure, such as, you know, social affordable housing. So really it's such an important opportunity, not just to support the low carbon transition, but to support us in building back our economies and societies coming out of a pandemic as well. So I think there's huge opportunity there. Real assets, if managed sustainably, is much better positioned to withstand, you know, changes in regulation and policy and technology and all the negative impacts caused by, you know, physical related climate risks like floods and sea level rise and fire hazards. So that there's huge opportunity for us in the real asset space to play a role in rebuilding, but also in creating more resilient portfolios for our investors and for the economy and society at large.
I totally understand that. I totally understand what you're saying. But the cynics might say it's very easy to introduce all this green energy into buildings and all these newfound regulations. But most of the houses that we have here in the UK certainly are much older. How are you going to go about trying to reduce carbon emissions, you know, into older buildings? Isn't that a challenge for you?
It's absolutely a huge challenge for everyone in our industry and sector. But we mustn't be daunted by it, because it is an important challenge that we have to address, because at least 70% of our building stock are existing buildings that have been around for 30, 40 years in some cases. So we have to work collaboratively, I think, as an industry to figure out how we can retrofit and refurbish and bring in the interventions that align with getting to net zero in a way that is cost effective, but actually providing resilience to these buildings and the occupiers that use them for the foreseeable future, because we cannot be left with what we call stranded assets, you know, assets that will not only lose its value, but they become less safe or unsafe. And it has implications on health and well-being as well for the occupiers. So it is a huge challenge to address the standing assets, you know, that we have. But if we work together as a community, I think we can find the solutions to address these challenges.
And I'm going to ask a really nasty question now and say, what will happen if you don't reach net zero by 2050?
I really don't think we should be thinking in a defeatist way about this, because we really need to be thinking about how much progress we have made as a collective group of actors across investors, companies, even down to grassroots level, due to the Attenborough and the Greta effect, for example. So no matter how daunting the task may be, I think we should believe in the human spirit of innovation and ingenuity to find the solutions in order to create a better society for future generations.
That's a really great and a meaningful answer, Xuan. I mean, talking about spirit, what do you think we should look for in COP26? It's coming up in November in Glasgow. everyone seems willing to do something, but will there be concrete proposals coming out of it?
I'm quite thoughtful about it because, yeah, you know, there's a lot of noise about COP and what's going to happen at COP, but really nothing is going to just happen at a single conference. What's important is what happens after the conference. So, I mean, we don't even know today whether there will be a physical conference or virtual conference, because there are just so many uncertainties with the global pandemic. But we do know that there's a lot of momentum across all the actors coming together, both private and public sector, and they are taking bold action. So it's no longer just about making commitments, because we've done that now. It's really about taking action and being held accountable to it. So really, I see COP as just a culmination of, to summarize what action needs to be done, and then it's let's prove it after COP.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, I wanted to end on a personal note. You're the proud mum of a 10-year-old daughter. Environment-wise, I suppose if you could change one thing for her and her generation, what would it be?
I would like my daughter and her children to grow up and appreciate the wonders of nature as I have, and not to be left with cleaning up the mess that my generation, the generation before me left for them. So there are many things, Frances, I think I would like to change, but if I had to choose one, it would be probably how we value the externalities that have been caused by our dependency on the natural ecosystem, you know, that has caused so much unimaginable pollution, you know, environmental degradation and biodiversity loss. So it's if we can really think about changing the rules of the game in terms of how we interact with and value nature, I think that would have a transformational impact, because nature, the economy and society should really be valued as one interconnected global system. And if we can crack that code, I think we would be able to solve a lot of other problems that we have created. And maybe if I can end on a quote, if I may, is that we cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them. That's a quote by Einstein. We as investors have a very key role to play. And there are lots of opportunities as well.
Well, wise words from Einstein and wise words from you, Xuan. Thanks so much for joining LGM Talks. We know how busy you are, but good luck. Good luck in the cause and good luck with COP and everything you do. And we all have a part to play. So it's been really great listening to you. Thank you. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording, and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties, and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions, and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. lgym.com.